I also view it as a concept clarifier. It's no secret that concepts drive motor patterns. And when you have a golfer that is 13 into out, the ball's going left, and he's thinking, oh, I'm just coming over the top, right? I'm swinging across it. When you can give them that concrete proof of like, no, that's not what's going on. You know, we need to try to move the needle in a different direction. Then it helps the buy-in, I've found.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was the voice of Rob Bales. He's a PGA teaching professional alongside one of my Mississippi State brethren, Seth Mers, under the supervision of Jason Sutton, who's at top 100 at the Carmel Country Club. And those three are really doing some awesome stuff. And Robbie and I just happened to be texting one time, and I offered to bring him on the show, and he decided to come on and share his insights. So we get a little golf nerdy in this podcast, which is fun. So if you like that kind of stuff, this podcast is for you. But before we dive into that podcast, this is the first chance I've had to talk to you guys since the Rob Bell Mental Toughness Workshop presented by Always Play On. That workshop went incredibly well. We had over 70 people in attendance. It was an inspiring and motivational weekend for us who participated, because that 2 hours that turned into closer to almost 3 hour workshop has so much engagement, so many activities and opportunities for the players and their parents to really interact and have the opportunity to have discussions regarding how they should best communicate and non-verbally communicate with each other. And without giving too many of the secrets away from what we covered in that workshop, one of the things that really stood out to me as a coach, and hopefully will to you as a parent, that I want to share with you real quick before this podcast, is that it doesn't matter what you say, it only matters what they hear. And that just rung really true to me from, you know, the last few years as me as a coach, and, you know, now as a dad. And I would think for most of you parents that listen to this and your coaches that listen to this, really think about what your athlete hears and what they interpret you saying, not so much what you said. And Rob had a really great exercise that demonstrated this rather impressively well. And hopefully the next time we have this workshop, you can have a chance to participate in it, because it really brought to light a lot of things that might be misconceptions to others and really helped bring home some truths to a lot of parents. And the feedback we've got from this workshop has just been outstanding. So I appreciate all of those that participated. I do. It was such a great opportunity to see you guys learn something from this workshop. And I think Rob and I plan on doing many more of these in the future, because we just had such a great time doing this thing. It was awesome for everybody. So with that, I'm going to let this podcast dive into what Rob had to share for us today. Rob Fails, that is. And I think him and I are going to have many more good discussions like this, and hopefully I can bring on the rest of the Carmel Country Club crew, and we can keep having some of these awesome discussions about teaching golf. So, enjoy.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Today on the podcast, I have the honor and privilege of bringing on Rob Fails. He is a instructor at the Carmel Country Club. He's alongside of top 100 Jason Sutton. So he gets to spend a lot of his day teaching alongside of the best in the biz, as well as teaching alongside one of my homeboys from Mississippi State, Seth Mers. Rob is also a PGA golf management graduate from Clemson. So he's probably still riding the high from the national championship game, but we'll ignore the fact that his quarterback has longer locks than most models. And we're getting right into the podcast. So Rob, say hello to everybody and give us a little background about who you are and how you got into the game.
Hey Matt, I love the quarterback. I love the lock.
So I can't help
don't hate on the lock, please.
There's too many memes going out right now to not tag on to that one.
Yeah, but first and foremost, thank you for having me on the show. It's quite an honor to be a part of your podcast and to join your list of attendees that you've had on here. So that's definitely a treat for me. I'm 24 years old. I've graduated Clemson in 2017 and I've been extremely fortunate with the people that I've been able to meet in this industry to give me the chance to do what I love to do, which is to teach golf.
Yeah, man. It's an interesting voyage that we take going through the PGA route, you know, you went through Clemson's, I went through Mississippi State's, and both are really good programs. And I was just kind of checking out your resume there a little bit of where you've bounced around to, and you've hit some nice little spots along the way. How did you end up picking Carmel as your place of landing?
Yeah. So, essentially what happened is I realized very early on in my internship process that I wanted to teach golf. And it just so happens that the year before my last internship year, we had a teaching summit at Clemson where we had Jason come talk as well as Kevin Britt, Alan Burton. Some of the names you hear me mention quite often when I talk about those who have influenced me. And I just was able to strike a relationship up with Jason and ask him to, share some of his wisdom with me and ask if I could come and watch him teach. And so he was obviously very gracious in letting me do that. And so on weekends where there wasn't a Clemson football game or if I didn't have anything, any obligations, I would come on down to Carmel and watch him teach for a full day and take notes and ask questions. And when it came time to decide where I wanted to do an internship, I ended up kind of finagling my course schedule a little bit, and Jason was able to create a position for me. So I had a lot of people who were instrumental in me getting to this point, and I can't thank Jason enough for the opportunities that I've had. So, I'm just happy being where I'm at and thankful for him and for the staff here at Carmel for being so welcoming to me.
Well, you know, it's interesting because a very similar, avenue happened for me, less knowing I wanted to be a teacher until my final internship. I had the opportunity to teach under Virgil Herring, and he was a Mississippi State guy. And honestly, I landed in Nashville because the assistant that came down was a Mississippi State guy that was there for a couple of years while I was there. So I knew him from, being students together, and thought it'd be fun to work at that facility and knowing that there was a, a top teacher at the facility going all the time. And then I was fortunate that my boss was, very lenient with my free time in that sense that, once my shift was done or if it was snow on the ground, cause I did a January to August internship, I could go down there and watch him do his thing as many hours as I wanted to, man. And I was in there so much that I actually took a nap or two every once in a while. you'd be down there after a 10-hour day and you catch the last couple hours of less than 2 minutes, hard to stay awake. But, it's always fun. And I think you have a great opportunity, and I like to hear more about how your facility works in the sense that you have a top coach located there. You have yourself and Seth teaching, as much as you guys can possibly teach. And you have you have the opportunity to, combine ideas and blend strategies and stuff like that. So what's like a typical planning session, like sitting there with a top 100 and two up and coming superstar coaches?
Yeah, we have quite a nice situation. So oftentimes what we'll do in every Tuesday, we'll do teacher training sessions. And this is just basically our time to talk together and collaborate. And, if I had a lesson that I wanted to share or if I had questions, on something that happened previously that week, or if Jason has something that he wants to present, or if Seth wants to talk about, our junior programs and, get some ideas on fun junior games. And that's really the time for us to really explore and to, rack our brains with, different strategies for a myriad of different topics. I mean, recently our meetings have revolved more around, getting our long-term coaching program set up. So it hasn't been quite as much, on the geeky end of the spectrum recently, but that's where the magic happens for sure.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think that's important to have that unity as a team, you know, as far as developing those plans to, you know, effectively make your students better, right? I mean, that's right. without any kind of measurable success, there's no way to actually monitor, you know, who's doing what and where, you know, and so that can create confusion.
Right.
To talk us more about some of the strategy you guys are taking on with the, you know, some long-term development, and I see you posting stuff online about going out to the golf course some, and you know, for us, that's going to come to a wrap here today as they double cover our greens, but talk to us a little bit more about, you know, how your development programs work and, you know, and the ability of doing drills and playing on the golf course.
Yeah. So, I'll just talk quickly about the structure. So usually we have done in the past, ever since I've been here, what's called a Biggest Loser program, where we sell hours of instruction and the members are able to use those hours however they want. And during the course of the season, we're tracking their handicaps, and the person who has the biggest percentage loss in handicap at the end of the year essentially wins. And you have, you know, team Jason, teams team Robbie, and team Seth. And so we all kind of go about the same way. And this year we're actually implementing something different. We felt like that structure had been extremely successful, but it kind of had run the end of its course. But we actually got this idea from Scott Kalx, who came and spoke and did his certification here at Carmel, is selling months where we can essentially spend as much time with them as possible. So unlimited hours for either 3, 6, or 12 months. And it hasn't really had a chance yet this year, obviously, to get going, but we're really, really excited about it. We think that it's going to allow us to spend more time with our students, be able to watch them practice, and then watch them play, which is something that I think coaching programs should all strive to do, is to spend more time on the golf course watching your students play.
Definitely. I mean, I think, and you know these guys too, there's a bunch of guys doing that kind of like a monthly plan already, and I picked up on that route in 2017, and I mean, it was the best thing I ever did for my kids that I teach. It's the time value of it just gets extrapolated. I don't do an unlimited route, but I do definitely give them way more bang for their buck than I probably deserve to do myself. But it's so much fun to be able to see your kids that you're coaching more often and make it affordable to the parent, because at that phase everybody kind of gets better, right? And and for me, I was maybe a year older than you when I kind of had like the realization, like, you know, the kids that want to get better are going to get better because they're willing to go do the work, they're willing to go on the range, they're willing to practice. For me, and I want your opinion on this too, for me it was the fringe kids, the kids that were kind of like, yeah, I like golf, I play in some tournaments, but I don't really know where I want it to take me. Those are the kids I kept not really losing, but I just couldn't get them to get out there and get after it, right? Or realize the work ethic behind it.
Right.
What's kind of your, obviously you haven't done the programming yet, but what's kind of your take on that? And where do you see the programming developing into?
So whenever we're talking about those fringe kids, the biggest thing I always try to do is, and this is going to be no surprise to him, but just try to make it as fun as possible. You can't have a dictator mindset when it comes to those kids. Actually, Jason just released a podcast in Orlando that he was spending time with, and he was actually sharing a condo with John Dunnigan, James Hong, Rob Holding, Jeff Smith, and several others, where they talked about this at length. And I would put a plug for Jason's podcast to go and listen to that, because I think that covers a lot of the really essential pieces that it takes to really get kids hooked on golf, is to make it game centered, to make it fun, and to interact with the kids the way that they need to be interacted with. I think there's always a time for being silly, being fun, but then there's also times to say, okay, well, they need a kick in the butt. So always trying to monitor how we're going to interact with each individual kid, I think, is important. you just have to do your research on, you know, how they're feeling in that moment, what maybe their family life is like, all that kind of good stuff. And yeah, and honestly, making it game centered, I think is the biggest thing. With some of our more elite juniors, I get them into, I still want them to play games as much as possible, but I have a little bit more leniency in prescribing drills that might not be as fun, that I think are going to be very helpful for their development. But yeah, I think that it just boils down to, can you give the kid the best opportunity that you can for them to get hooked on golf? And in my opinion, that's for golf to be fun. So.
Oh, definitely. And I got about 20.
I don't know if I have much.
Yeah. I got about 20 minutes left on that podcast to go. even listen at time and a half, I'm a slow listener. But the interesting part I found in that too was talking about when John Dunnigan brought up the whole like family life and how he kind of like goes opposite of what, you know, they might have at home. If the parents like hammering them at home, then he makes it fun. And, you know, if the parents not really making it engaging, then, you know, he finds some way to make it engaging. And yeah, that really kind of struck a chord with me as, you know, as entertainment. And yeah, the fun value, I think, you know, is such a critical portion to having a lesson. And I think, you know, you have to have a blend of being the coach that allows the player to go home feeling good, but at the same time go home hungry. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you don't want to, like, I've seen plenty of coaches that goes out there and man, you'll walk away feeling like $1 million. And then like 3 days later you go back and go, did I really get better? Or did I just, I mean,
yeah,
you know, and you kind of have that like, wait a second, what just happened? Right. And then you have the other coaches that, and I'm not going to name any names, but I've had a couple lessons from other coaches where I was like sitting there like, and I'm not a bad player in my own right, and I know the golf swing. I'm sitting there like going, wait a second, I got to go about the shaft in the plane and then around the body to the vertical of like, what?
Yeah.
You know?
And, yeah.
And so you kind of have to find that right dynamic of what, you know, of the kids' mentality. Are they kind of that engineer brain, want to know the numbers, want to see the you know, the geeky stuff, if you will?
Oh, yeah.
Or is it the kid, like, I got one kid, he's one of the best players in the state right now as far as rankings goes. And if I drop any kind of like doctoral term of supination or pronation or anything like that, he's like, wait, what are you talking about? And I'm like, yeah, just shut the face, you know? And I think you just got to tailor it to the kid. Right. And I think the next question I have for you is like, when you sit down and structure out your lessons, you know, how, like, and let's say you've been working with somebody for a while, how are you developing a plan for your students so that they can achieve success if the lesson goes the way you want it to go?
Yeah. So one of the quotes that's been on my radar recently that I think answers this question well is, you have to be able to protect your students from your own influence. And my influence oftentimes, if I'm not careful, is I tend to be a swing geek. You know, I want to get in there. I want to get on track, man. I want to, you know, use video. I want to capture on body track. I want to, you know, we're going to get a 3D system, which may or may not be a good thing for me here in the future. But I have to be able to protect my students from my influence. And oftentimes that means, you know, even though I see something in their golf swing that I would like to change, I don't think is a great idea for them, I'll say, hey, you know, let's go play. Let's go work on short game. Let's go work on putting. Let's get out on the golf course. And more often than not, we don't give our students enough credit for being able to make certain movements functional for them, even though it might not be, in our opinion, at this point, a good idea for them, if that makes sense. So
yeah, sure.
I've got one kid that if he didn't jump, basically get both toes, but both heels airborne, he wouldn't hit it anywhere. I mean, the way that he creates power for him is to jump. So I can, you know, not protect him from my influence and put all these things in that are going to help him rotate. But for what he needs for this year, he needs to be able to compete. I'm just going to try to evolve out of, take him through an evolution process out of that pattern instead of taking it away. I'm always very careful about trying to take away a power source from a young student. Sure. And so that's where, like, yeah, do I love the jump? Do I love a whole lot of early extension? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
But I have to be able to protect them from my preferences, because I know that if I take that early extension away from him right now, he's not going to be able to compete. So
no,
I think that's really the key for that.
I mean, that's huge, right? And I you hit a huge nail on the head, because what are most parents going to see when they see their little Johnny standing on the driving range jumping off the turf like Bubba Watson, and the head's going up, right? Oh my God.
Oh my gosh.
But, you bring up a good point about those power sources, though, because I too have a student. She is a phenomenal athlete, like freakish. And on force plate, she can apply 225% of her body weight at 13 years old. She can do it at 12, actually.
That's awesome.
Yeah, right? So what do you do with a kid that can jump literally over twice their body weight off the ground? And to your point, she did it early, and just had a wild flip. And actually, I got video where her left foot ends up like a foot behind her, because she's jumping so rapid time before she's twisting. And, you don't want, like you say, you don't want to take it away. But at the same time, you have to be proficient at the three power sources you get, right? Some horizontal force, some rotational force, and some verticals. But you can't, like you said, you can be really good at one, but you can't forget the other two, right? So you can't be deficient
at
the other power sources and when they line up. And so for us, it's kind of like to your same point there is like, we were just working on, let's just increase some rotation before you jump. Can you give me a little twist and then go? And see what we turn into. And that did marvels for her, right? It got her away from, well, the shanks at one point. But, it's one of those things that, I think you're doing a great job and Jason is doing a great job of teaching you two out there of, how the body works and how to apply those forces, right? So what are some of the fun stuff that you're learning right now that, maybe 15-year-old Robbie wish he knew when he was trying to get that college scholarship?
Well, I think one of the biggest things I've learned is that you can't assume kinetics from looking at kinematics.
True.
So a good example for that is let's go back to our jumping example. So just because you see a player sit and rotate like crazy doesn't mean that they're not using the ground in a vertical sense. I've seen 3D. I've seen force play data where a player is, it looks like they're not jumping at all. They're just rotating. But then when you look at the verticals, it's through the roof. So, I'd be very careful about teaching someone to jump again, a kinematic in order to try to get a kinetic, which is the vertical forces out of the ground. Mm-hmm. I would be, I'm big on a mantra that John Sinclair has shared with me is that it's not the position, it's the motion. And so I don't necessarily care if the lead wrist is flexed at the top or extended, neutral, it doesn't really matter, but it's the motion it goes through from address through impact. And you're going to see it flex off the ball, you're going to see it extend a bit to the top, then it's going to go towards flexion coming down somewhere around shaft parallel to the ground, and then you're going to start seeing it go towards extension.
Yep.
And that's what I teach. I teach the motion, not okay, your lead wrist has to be flat at a certain point. I don't believe that's the case.
No, I think that's where your credit, that 3D stuff you're talking about, the like hack motion, right? That wrist sensor. Dude, I have fun with that thing. Like that's just, it should be illegal how much fun I've had with that thing. But you're right. I love that mantra. It's like how you create the motion is more important than the position. I mean, that's true.
Yeah. You're teaching the shape of the curve, not the value of where the curve is.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I think that's kind of the difference now between, I'm not going to say like parents and coaches, but maybe somebody that doesn't do it for a living. Right. But you got like your golf nut, right? And they love golf stuff, but they're not in those circles. They're not in the conversations of talking about how to apply the right amount of the right motions to create the images you want to see. And I think that's the struggle that, you know, when you have to have some of those conversations, if you're not really familiar with how that works, it could be tough to communicate that what you're seeing on 2D doesn't give you everything. And just looks at, like, you know, just because it looks this way in two dimensions on face on, that does not mean anything.
Yeah, no, a very, you know, one example is if you're looking at the overall path of the club, a small change in camera angle from down the line or face on can drastically change the perception that you have. You know, if the camera's high, I prefer for what I look at more often than not on video is I want the camera to be around hand height, shooting through the hands parallel to the target line.
Yep.
So if it's higher than that, then you're going to see takeaways that look like they're inside. You're going to see top of the backswing that look like it's across the line, and it's not. You're just looking at it through the wrong lens. You're making an assumption based on limited information. One thing is that a lot of people like to draw the butt line, right? Mm-hmm. But how many of them put the camera on the butt line so they can see it?
That's right. That's absolutely
not,
right.
Not very many.
And they get caught up with the fact that you have to keep your butt on the line, and they forget that your torso is rotating and that your right cheek's going to touch it going back, and then your left cheek's going to touch it going through, not both cheeks the whole way.
Well, they also forget that the pelvis isn't a circle.
True.
It's wider than it is deep. So if the center of the pelvis stays in the exact same location and you have any amount of rotation, then you're going to see either the right side or the left side of the pelvis break through that line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Plus it's tilting. That blows some people's minds. And you're not staying bent over in forward bend as you go back, which blows some people's minds.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so there's a lot of, it's funny to talk about the camera angle stuff too, man, because I've gotten into this online coaching game. And I mean, some of the angles I've gotten, I'm just like going, man, I can't help you with that. Like, I had a guy.
They'll put it on the ground. Yeah. They'll put on the ground, on the ball line.
I got a guy. Like, this is classic. I had a guy put the camera down on the ground behind him. So I'm looking at his butt.
Nice.
As he sends me a video. And it took my wife telling me that I shouldn't post it to my Instagram account on how not to send a video submission.
Oh my gosh.
But, you know, it's one of those things that the camera angle is completely overlooked. And I think that's where, you know, 3D doesn't really lie to you. You know, it takes away the camera for the most sense, because when you're using a radar, as long as you're lined up and the target is where it is and the player is actually trying to, you know, with somewhat coordinated alignment, you know, hit it at that target and make adjustments, you know. And, you know, that's the other point too, right? I mean, you can have in 3D, you can have a guy that's just drastically over the top, 10 degrees over the top, going outside in at the ball. And you have him line up, I don't know, 50 yards right. Now all of a sudden he's zero. Like, oh, look at that. You're great. You know? Yeah. And so parts of that you got to be careful about too when you're looking at the 3D stuff, you know? And I think that's, you know, an interesting conversation too. But, What's some of the tech? I mean, obviously TrackMan is a big part of a lot of people's coaching right now. I know you guys use it, but like, what's some of the tech that maybe, or training aids that you're using right now that maybe some people aren't aware of or aren't using as much as you think they should?
Well, it's not anything. It's not very much of it's really high tech. I got to be honest. You know, when we talk about, see, we got to make the distinction between training aids and measurement aids. I use TrackMan as a measurement. I use BodyTrack as a measurement. I want to know what you're doing when you're hitting it great. That's really what I'm using it for. I'll sometimes cue the feet. I actually do that quite a bit to change the path, but I'm not just using BodyTrack exclusively as I don't view it as a training aid. Mm-hmm. Sam Putlab, we use it all the time, and depending on how you're using it, you know, you could use it a lot of different ways, but I view it again as a measurement. I want to see what's going on between the golfer's hands and the putter. Really, it's as simple as that. So when we talk about training aids, that's getting into a different topic. I mean, I use a lot of alignment sticks. I found a couple really cool ways to grip the club to change. I've learned some cool ways to grip the club that will make the golfer do something that you want it to do. Sure. I use the Orange Whip wedge in a way that you wouldn't think it should be used. I use the Orange Whip quite a bit. But I also use a lot of like tees, towels. I use a foam roller sometimes for different things. It's just kind of just very simple stuff like that, that can make a big difference without necessarily needing to spend $25,000 on tech.
Sure. And I think that's a good distinction. And then I've had a chat with Will Wu. You know, you also have to be careful with, you could call them assistance devices where that, you know, they become a little bit too reliant on it. Right. So in the words of Dunnigan, you know, he who does the work does the learning, right?
Yep.
So you don't want to necessarily have, someone pushing on the club when they need to be pulling on the club or whatever, right? You know, back and forth.
Yep.
You want to help them create that pulling motion if that's what you're going for, or twisting or whatnot.
Right.
And that's where we also have to be really careful, you know. And I have a, it's funny, I have a training aid I call the rib breaker where I just stuck a shaft in the back of the right. And it's like the utmost anti-flip device, right? I mean, it's used, if you flip it, sure. You're going to gore yourself. And it's always interesting to me, and I want to get your take on this too, is when I give them that rib breaker thing, right, man, they got the craziest amount of shaft length, but they do it the absolute worst way, right? They just lean it down the lateral line and just shank it the first one almost every time. Some people figure out
this,
you go around your body, and that's how you don't shank it. But it's interesting because as soon as I take that rib breaker away, right, and put a wedge back in their hand, I'm like, all right, now let's try and replicate what you just did. Like half life right there. It's already back to almost where they were instantly. And they look at the video and they're kind of like, well, what just happened? I'm like, were you still worried about that thing breaking you in the rib? And they're like, no. I'm like, you were worried about hitting that golf ball again, weren't you? They go, yeah. I was like, crap. You know, it's entertaining. So that's where I was kind of getting curious with you is like, you know, what, maybe there's something that you're doing that you can see a benefit from training aids where it, you know, it has that carryover, you know what I mean? And so what's kind of some of the stuff that you see people do and that they can maybe translate over, or maybe, you know, the opposite, what's some stuff that you've seen not work and maybe people need to get away from doing?
Right. Okay. So, I'll share what I've learned from Tyler Farrell, and it's one of the best things that's helped me. So, essentially when you're using training aids, when you're trying to make a technical change, there needs to be a sort of progression to the learning. So it's very difficult to go straight from the drill, where it's very, very concrete, to more of an abstract feeling. So the four stages, what Tyler calls the four stages of awareness, are transcendental, receptors, cortical, and complex. So when you look at transcendental, basically what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to create a drill. And I think the definition of a good drill is, and I got this from Ryan Chaney, is that it forces the golfer to make the motion the way you desire to solve the problem. So that stick, that alignment stick, that rib breaker, literally forces the golfer to solve the problem the way that you desire. So it's a good drill. Depending on how you use it, I tend to use it more for release mechanics. I don't like using it at speed because I don't like what happens with the hands and arms post impact with it. But I like it for like 9-3 release mechanics.
Yeah, I'm talking 40-50 yard pitch shots is what we're doing most of it with.
Yeah,
not hardly.
Yeah, anything. So the key to transcendental is the golfer can't be able to argue with it. Like if I put a stick over the ball on about a 30-degree angle and say, okay, the club should never hit this before it hits the ball. Like you've got to be able to hit the ball before the club ever thinks about getting out to the target line. The golfer can walk around and look at it, but they can't argue with it. It's concrete. It's fixed. It's there. it's transcendental. There's no way that you can possibly cheat the drill, right?
Right.
So the next stage of that is receptors. So if, let's say that they are doing the drill correctly, or let's say they're not doing the drill correctly. So the receptors is when you as a coach need to explore a cue, and I prefer external cues to internal. So a example of that would be, instead of telling someone that I want your lead wrist to flex 25 degrees coming down, I put the loft indicator, you know, the little metal thing, it's got the stick.
Yep.
I'll put the loft indicator and I'll stand kind of behind the golfer and further, like behind into the backside of the golfer, and say, okay, I want you to point that thing at me coming down as soon as you can. And so the golfer is not having to think about the wrist flexion, but they're able to solve the problem, which forces them to flex the wrist. So then when they're able to do that, I say, okay, so what do you feel? How would you describe that motion to someone else who has no idea what you're doing? So with the receptors, you're trying to create sensations. You're trying to get the golfer aware of their fields that they use when they solve the problem in the transcendental phase. So that's where I'm a big fan of using my hands to create resistance in the undesirable direction to force them to create the desired motion. So that's when I'll go in and I'll move them around and I'll use my hands to try to give them a feel for what they need to do to solve the problem.
Yeah.
So after they've agreed on that, and the third step is the cortical. So that's where it becomes important that they are able to identify the error without my help. Okay. So let's say that we get away from the drill, and they're making these motions and they're aware of their feels, but I see like they make one rep that's incorrect. Then I'll stop them. I say, okay, something was off there. What do you think it was? So they need to be able to recall the motion. They need to say, oh, I felt like I didn't. And whatever their feel was, they told me. I don't tell them what to feel. I want them to tell me what they feel. If they are able to accurately diagnose it, and I love it when they're actually making the reps themselves and then they realize when it doesn't happen and they fix it on the next one, that's when you know that you've nailed the third stage, that cortical stage where they can identify it without the use of you or the training aid. Only after that, will we go to the fourth stage, which is the complex. So I'll say, okay, I'm going to add the golf ball, right? So now you have to be able to coordinate the low point. You have to be able to coordinate the face and the path with the motion that we're trying to make. So a lot of times people will jump straight from transcendental, like, okay, I'm going to give you this drill, to complex. And what happens is like, it's such a big gap between the two that their brain's going to default to solve the problem in front of them, which is the golf ball. And so they might make the motion a little bit better, but it's not going to be anywhere near exactly correct or what you want them to do.
That's the nail on the head, man. I mean, that's it right there. It's always entertaining to the student, right? I think when they kind of have that like moment of like clarity of like, wait a second. I can do this without the ball there. And I have put a ball here and now I'm baffled and it goes sideways. And to your point right there, I mean, that's, as you go through those different phases, it's just part of learning.
Correct.
And it's,
but there is essentially a cheat, right? So, you can get around it as long as the drill forces them to hit the golf ball, solving the problem the way that you desire. So that's where, And you still want to go through the second and third stages. You still want them to try to be aware of, you know, their feels. And then if it wasn't quite right, what did they miss? But some of the best drills actually are such that you won't hit you literally will not hit the golf ball unless you do the correct motion. That's where a lot of the stuff that I'm looking into as far as the grip and the ways that you can change your hands on the club to make that a reality.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, I mean, that's a podcast in itself talking about,
yeah,
you know, delivery action and trail arm action and laid wrist. Yeah, you can go down that rabbit hole deep. you know, that's great insight. So, I mean, I think that helps, you know, a lot of people listening too, is, you know, it's kind of like that intent a little bit, right? You know, you can get overly concerned with, like, I got to make contact to the golf ball. And I find anyways, that typically as a player gets more comfortable with the fact that they're not going to miss it or shank it or, mm-hmm. you know, top it or whatever, they can,
yeah.
you know, the thought of like having to make contact goes away, and they can kind of keep those cues and the drills that you're working on stay focused. I find that, you know, with the beginner, a lot of times they sit there and the concern is put club behind ball and make sure I don't miss.
Right. And, that's right.
And when that's eating up your entire thought, you got 0.2 seconds to get it from the top to the ball. And there's, you can't think your way through that. It's not possible. You have to learn it and make it a habit. And so it's definitely interesting to watch as players get better and that concern about hitting it. And I always get cracked up, you know, when people ask me, it's like, you know, where do you look on the ball or what do you think about hitting the ball? I'm like,
yeah.
I'm gonna be honest with you.
I have no idea.
Like, that's my favorite answer. Like, you know, do you look at the front of the ball? Do you look at the back of the ball? And I'm like, man, there's a white egg in front of me, and I'm trying to crack it. Like, that's all I got.
Yeah. I just know that the ball is there, and my target is there.
Yeah, well, and I think
that's all I really know.
There's a lot of that, you know. In the I've had the chance to dabble with the focus band stuff a good bit, and you can kind of. It's always kind of fun to sit there and watch people's brains. You know, it's a rough version of an EEG machine, and this gives you a basic idea of brain waves and frequencies and stuff like that. And it's, you know, it's interesting when people start to slow down and get in a little bit more of the alpha waves where things are, you know, they can kind of, the sense of time starts to kind of go away from a little bit, and they can kind of stay in that focus. Yep.
So have you found with the focus band that, so I'm just curious. So,
yeah.
Do you feel like it's promoting a sense of calmness over the ball, or do you feel like it's promoting more focus, like more intense focus in what you're doing?
All right. So there. Yeah. All right. This is a good one. So, for me, and what I've seen, I think the focus band helps players learn to find that sense of calm prior to the hit. Right. You know, because when you're trying to analyze a shot, you got to have a little bit of that the data analytics going on, you know, wind, distance,
right.
all that stuff. So you have to be able to flip the switch. Right. So you have to be able to go into that side and then, you know, they say go left brain, go right brain, but pretty much, you know, just be able to think about the shot and then be able just to react. But what I find is just because you're able to go into that, you know, right brain state, that slower wave state, doesn't equate to good golf shots. Right. I mean, I think it just helps you get to be a little more athletic and lets you be a little more free. But here's an interesting little tidbit I had. I was working with an LPGA player a few years back, and she would get into that slower wave state. The right brain would be going on focus band, and she would hit every shot left. Right. And we get to the fourth hole. It's a par three. And she bounces it off the left edge of the green, and she looks at me about ready to murder me, right? She goes, every time I do what you tell me to do, it goes left. And I said, all right, hold on. We're missing something. Something's not right. You know, this is my early days of focus band. And I told her, I said, all right, look, set up to the ball, find that sense of calm, let's get the thing humming again. And I want you to close your eyes and point to your target with like your left arm. Just point to it and tell me where you're pointing, right? And she pointed dead on the spot that she just hit the last shot. And she's like,
wow.
Yeah, she's like, whoa, hold up a second, right? So we let two groups play through trying to like just work
on
getting set up and focusing on an intent to where her brain actually perceives a target in the right position. The next shot she hit, now granted, we spent like 15 minutes on the tee box just working through this. The next shot she hit it to 4 inches. Right.
Wow.
And yeah, exactly. Right. And so she's like, okay, there's something deeper going on here. I'm like, yeah. You know?
So that's interesting. Cause, James Hung, this was a Facebook post a little while back, but he had a very similar situation where the golfer would lose awareness of the target, like at the top of the backswing. So he had him take the backswing and stop. He said, okay, now point at the target. And it was like 30 yards left.
Oh yeah.
So how did you, was it just a matter of, you know, did you just have a hunch? Like, how did you know to go there? Like, I think that's incredible.
Yeah. So, well, I mean, you got to consider the player I'm working with, right? I'm working with a girl that's been on the LPGA and Symetra Tour off and on for 5 years. So it wasn't like I was working with Joe Blow 20 handicap where the dispersion pattern could be anything, right? I mean, every shot was 20, 30 yards left. It was just a consistency thing. And I'm sitting there going, man, she is absolutely hammering. I mean, she was hammering it and it was going left. And I was like, there's got to be something up here. And, you know, because she would line up to the target perfect. I'm like, and so it's something just, I think, you know, Tischler might have said something to me that just my brain just kind of clicked and said, you know what, let's just see where she thinks the target's at. And, you know, I think there's a legitimate argument. And if I had the resources and the wherewithal to do a study, I think there's a legitimate argument to say, part of why people swing the way they swing the club is they have a wrong perception of where the target is in relation to
where the target is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, a guy that thinks the target is way to the left is going to, you know, move the golf club in a sense to make that coincide with where they think the target's at. Right. And that's where you could see maybe some changes of action.
Yeah.
And
yeah, please continue.
No, you're good. So I think it's just one of those things that, as you work through teaching, it's important to also know, like, you know, where do they think the target needs to be? I mean, I had this conversation with a kid I picked up at the end of last year where, you know, I asked him, you know, what's a good draw look like to you, right? And he's hitting 9-iron and he rips a shot on TrackMan and I could already tell you he was lined up too far right. And, you know, he hits a shot and he's like, that was it. That's the shot I want to hit. Like, that's the one. He goes, yeah, that's a good shot. I'm like, okay. That had 93 feet of curve. I'm like, most would deem that a hook. And I'm like, we got to tighten that up to like less than 10 feet. And he's like, oh, wow. I'm like, yeah. So we're going to change that intent of what you think a draw is.
What's funny is that I've actually had that same. So like I had a golfer who just was a chronic slicer, you know, your classic. And he hits about a 20-yard cut. Like, it starts left and it cuts back to target. And he said, see, I just want to hit him dead straight, just like that. I'm like, hold on.
Exactly.
Pardon me?
Yeah, exactly.
And TrackMan's great because it has the ball flight. And you say, okay, if I showed you this picture and then I showed you that ball flight, would you say that they're the same? And he was adamant. He was like, no, that was not the ball flight. Like, that wasn't even close to what just happened. I'm like, no. I was like, that was a 20-yard cut.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Well, and I think that's the benefit. Like, so I know a couple of great coaches that know phenomenal amounts of material, but forget the fact you're teaching a human, right?
Right.
Teaching robots and the technology ends up being a killer to their ability to be great coaches. And you have to keep in the back of your mind that, like, and this is just my opinion, that the tech is solely there to validate what you're doing as a coach.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely. Can't agree more.
Yeah. And if you're using it as a crutch to make the changes in a person's swing, you need to learn more about the motion of the golf swing in the body.
What changes the numbers, right?
Exactly. Because, I mean, to me, I mean, it's like TrackMan, I mean, it's great. I run it throughout every lesson. But it's like literally like they hit three or four shots. I've already know what I'm going to do with the golf swing. I look at the numbers. Yep, that makes sense. It rarely I get somebody in there and it's like, whoa, how are you doing that? But, you know, for the most part, you see the motion. It makes sense in your mind. And then you start tearing apart, building up, this is what we're going to do, you know, blah, yada, yada. And then you go in and, you know, 10, 15 minutes later, look back at the numbers and say, see, we moved all that. And now you're, you know, face is square to your path and you're going much more towards your target. You hit the appropriate amount down or whatever. And, you know, and the TrackMan was just there to like, so the student can go, oh man, I am getting better. You know, not like numbers. And that was,
go ahead. The other thing is, I also view it as a concept clarifier, right? Yeah. So it's no secret that concepts drive motor patterns. And when you have a golfer that is 13 into out, the ball's going left and he's thinking, oh, I'm just coming over the top, right? I'm swinging across it. Sure. When you can give them that concrete proof of like, no, that's not what's going on. You know, we need to try to move the needle in a different direction. Then it just makes them that much more, it helps the buy-in, I've found.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, for me, it's, I had a one a week ago. The kid was 23 degrees inside out. So there's one for you.
that's got to be a track man.
To the kid's credit, in 6 days he had it going 7. So that was impressive.
Nice.
I think, you know, part of the track man thing, and then we'll kind of move to wrapping this thing up. But I think the other part of the, that I like to express to my students, and track man helps in this sense, is like you, swinging the club. You don't have to be at zero. Like that's not
no.
The goal is to get it to within a manageable number that you can keep the ball in front of you and you can play your dispersion. But,
yep.
But, you know, taking the kid that, like I just said, it was at 23 degrees inside out. You know, I looked at him, I said, here's what you got to understand. I'm like, 23 degrees is a huge change to get to zero. Most people have a hard enough time just moving at 10. I'm like,
yeah.
In essence, you're moving at double that. So I'm like, if you came in this week and you put it under 10 for me, and you're floating somewhere around 10 degrees inside out, you may still not be hitting the shots you want to hit, but you just moved your path 10 degrees. I'm like, that is no small feat. So,
no.
And I think that's kind of something we have to consider when we're swinging. You know, maybe people move the club differently. It's like you have to express to them like you don't have to be zero. Let's just say you got to be inside, I don't know, 4 degrees. Okay, plus or minus, doesn't matter, just somewhere in that window. And just keep the face between your path and zero, and you got a chance to play the game pretty darn good. And
right. And
as long as you can get
it. So how do you
– Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, as long as you can get it through their mind that they don't have to be at zero, and that when they look at that daunting number of, you know, where people come in, they're like 8, 9, 10, 12, 20 degrees inside out, over the top, or whatever – that they don't have this monumental task. I think it really helps encourage them to make the change.
So, how do you handle golfers? Because this happens. I think it probably happens to everyone. Where you have different types of students, where it takes them a year to change where the club is an inch, and you have players who they come back and it's 180 degrees the other way. Like they've completely overdone it. They're really, really fast changers.
Sure.
What have you done to kind of navigate that scenario?
Well, I think you figure that out as a teacher, right? You have no idea. The first time somebody walks into your student, into your bay as a student, you have no idea who you're getting, right? So as far as like work ethic and ability to make changes, you can get a concept of how athletic they are, but you also have to monitor them, right? So my sister-in-law is a great example. I coached her through her last couple of years of high school in her collegiate career. And she would absolutely hammer out changes like unbelievably well. And the first day she came into me, I mean, that thing was laid off so hard. It was almost pointing down to her butt. And, you know, and I was like, all right, we got to get this thing more across the line. And, you know, and she got to a phase where she was striping it for like 3 weeks. And I'm like, man, this is great. Just keep doing what you're doing. And then like a week before state championships or senior year, she comes in and that thing's pointed over her noggin so far that it's like, you know, whatever. And I'm like, whoa, what happened? She goes, well, you keep telling me to get across the line. I was like, whoa, you know, this is like early in my teaching phase. I was like, all right, this is something I got to, you know, consider. And I think you just have to, watch your students as you work with them. Right. And I think that's what you're going to find beneficial as you work through this more of a monthly development program where you can see your players. Like I can see my kids if they get into the mid level to the upper level, they're spending anywhere between 9 and 13 hours with me a month. Right. So it's really hard not to see what's going on. You know what I mean? But like when you're teaching a kid and you might see them every other week for an hour, man, I mean, anything can happen. Right. You know? And so, I think you just have to know who your student is. And then after a few lessons, you have to start to understand, you know, what, you know, is this player, you know, I think there's two pieces to it. One, the athletic ability is a big part. If you got somebody who's a freak of an athlete, they'll make changes in a heartbeat. Yep. I mean, it's crazy.
Yep.
The other part of it is their mentality. You know, how comfortable are they being uncomfortable? And that's the real nugget. If they can live in a world where it feels like garbage for a little bit to make that change, they're going to kill it. But then you have some that want to live in that little comfort bubble where it's like,
kinda,
this is kind of what Coach Matt wants me to do. But this is kind of like something I like to feel. And, you know, whenever I do it, he says, it doesn't really feel quite right. So I'm going to stay where I stay a little bit more comfortable. You know, I think you just kind of have to, you know, you kind of have to take it on, I think, by season two, right? I mean, you can't, in my opinion, you can't throw somebody a major movement pattern change like in July, pre-tournament champions, pre-state. You just can't do that to them. You have to keep it to a performance base and like, look, this is what you got. And as long as we keep the face here, you won't hit that ball right anymore, right? Or left or whatever, right? And you keep it that small, make a manager misses, make their short game impeccable, and then, you know, they're statistically bound to make a few enough birdies to get around the golf course.
Yeah.
Then you get to the winter side of things, and then you go, we're going to tear you apart, and we're going to, you know, we're going to absolutely fix this piece of the puzzle. And, you know, your mission by, you know, like I do a winter program from December 1st to the end of March 31st. I had every kid write down a goal, three goals they wanted to achieve by April 1. And we're coming up on the halfway mark, and tonight is the the kind of like the halfway checkpoint where I'm going to look at him and say, where you at? How do you feel about it? You know, you got eight more weeks left to get your goal done. Are you going to do it? Are we there? Do we need to double time it? You know, where are we at? And I think that's where you can set the tone for some of the kids. And, you know, some of them might be on that path. Some of them might have to kick in the butt a little bit. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, there's never going to be a right answer to that question as far as what do you do with the kids that can overdo it versus underdo it. You just have to you just have to know who you're working with. And I think you also have to set realistic expectations for those players. I think as a kid that, you know, struggles with achieving benchmarks with swing position, you know, swing mechanics or whatever, performance mechanics, you have to set realistic goals. Like you got a kid that's kind of half in, half out, and you're trying to get them to hit putts down a ruler. You know, set a real soft goal of like, hey, can you get 10? They come in, I got 10. Great, can you do 15? Can you do 20? You know, kind of set small goals. And then, you know, you got the kids that are going to go there and just rip it apart, and they come in like, I did 35, coach. I'm like, great, can you do 70? Right?
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to set it up for them so that they – so it feeds that little demon they got inside of them that they're trying to chase. And – I think that's the best part about coaching to me is, and I'm sure you're already getting the taste of it. It's like, and I think it's what makes me love doing what I'm doing so much. It's like, you don't know what you're going to get every day. Even if he's the same person every day, you don't know what you're going to get. You know, like that kid, that kid be walking in, his girlfriend just dumped him for his best friend, and he's going to be kicking himself, you know, into that front door. You got to sit down and go, hey man, Yeah, and you don't know. I mean, you can teach that kid for 3 years. And so it's definitely a fun little game to coach, I think, personally.
Absolutely, but, yeah.
Robbie, I know you're a busy man, and the range is opening up, and you got to get people better. I don't want to hog up more of your time, but I've appreciated every minute of your time. But before you run off –
Hey, it's been fun.
Well, we're doing it again. Don't worry. And maybe we'll get Seth in there to get his upside down.
Yeah. On things.
Give us a little something to think about as we go forward throughout the day, and, you know, maybe a little thing that you live by or a mantra or, you know, just a thing of inspiration. But give us a little words of wisdom from Robbie Fales.
Yeah. So I'd say the biggest thing that has helped not only my coaching, but my life is an understanding of how the way the mind works. So I'm not a big fan of I don't love going out and reading like self-help books, inspirational quotes. I don't think they really hold merit, because when you're relying on things externally to cause you to try to feel a certain way, it's just not the way it works. So the way I like to think about it is the mind works from inside out. So my current state of mind is essentially going to determine the way I perceive what happens out there. So if something happens and, you know, here's a good example. Like if I'm driving down the road and I get cut off in traffic, you can think of times when you have been just so angry with that person. You've been like, oh, how could they do that? Like what a jerk. But you can also probably think of times when you said, okay, that's fine. Like he or she is probably in a hurry. Like I've got nowhere to be. So if it were possible for things externally to cause you to feel a certain way, then getting cut off would always make you feel that way, but it doesn't, because the mind ebbs and flows. So I don't try to control, I never try to control my feelings and my thoughts, because it's a fleeting battle. But what I can control is how I project those feelings and thoughts onto others. So just because I feel cluttered up in my head, I feel like I'm not seeing things clearly, doesn't mean I can't be kind, loving, and compassionate to everyone that I come across. But yeah, as soon as someone says, oh, it's not okay to feel anxious, it's not okay to feel angry, it's okay to feel everything. Everyone always feels everything. And trying to control it is only going to make it worse. So just understanding that life works inside out, not outside in, has helped me tremendously. So that's what I charge everyone who asks me that question to consider.
Man, that's awesome insights and very mature insights for, you know, being 23. So, you know, kudos to you. You're a step ahead of the game in most situations. I'll tell you that right now. But, you know, I think it's a great insight into how to live your life, because just like you said, I mean, the brain's not a fixed mindset. It's constantly,
no.
It's constantly hungry. It always wants questions. And you just have to feed it, and whatever you're feeding it is what it's going to show up. And we have to be careful which little angel on our shoulder we're feeding,
one we're projecting. Yeah. We can't control which angel is talking to us the loudest, but what we can control is which one we listen to.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. So Robbie, what are some of the best ways for people to find you and follow what you're doing?
Yeah, you know, I'm always open for people to text me, so I'll give out my number if that's okay. It's 540-209-5024, but you can also reach me on social media at Rob Fails Golf on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.
Solid, man. Well, I appreciate it again, brother, and thank you.
No, thank you.
And we'll do this again soon.
Hey, I learned a lot, so keep the calls coming. I'm always... always welcome the opportunity to come chat with you, Matt. Thank you.
And that's a wrap, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you enjoyed what Robbie and I had to share with you today. Like I said, what they're doing over there in Carmel Country Club under the supervision of Jason Sutton, Robbie and Seth Mers are doing some awesome things in promoting this game. And I can't wait to have on the rest of the crew from Carmel, as that will definitely happen in the future. So, hope you're able to take away a little bit of the golf nerdiness that we talked about. Robbie and I like talking about the golf swing, and we had a good time, and I wish we could have dove a little bit deeper, but unfortunately podcasts can only go on for so long without losing your attention. But with that, I would like to say thank you for listening. As always, it is my pleasure to bring this podcast to you guys, and if you would be so kind to support us, to leave us a 5-star rating and write a review in your podcast apps, as it helps us as we promote the podcast to the masses. And you can follow us on social media, Facebook's Junior Golf Blueprint, and then you can follow me at Matt Walter PGA for all other forms of social media. So I hope all of you have a great weekend, and I look forward to chatting with you guys again real soon.